All right. Have you messed around with that chat GTP thing?
No.
No?
All right. Yeah, did you tell me to mess? What is? I don't know what you're talking about.
You don't know what that is?
Chat GTP.
GPT, GTP, something like that. It's the AI program.
Oh, no.
It's something and it gives you an answer.
Are we going to come clean and say that this whole podcast has been AI?
Has it been AI? I wonder if the podcast could be AI. I don't know. See, my point, I've been asking it just literary questions. I haven't been getting philosophical or technical with it.
Yeah.
But I haven't been too impressed with the literary stuff.
Okay.
I asked it when we were doing the Blithedale romance.
Yeah.
There's a veiled lady in Infinite Jest. Right. And so I asked, I was like, is there a connection between the veiled lady and it just gave me like cliff notes. Like it gave me a summary of the veiled lady in Infinite Jest. And then it gave me a little summary of Blithedale, and it gave the wrong person as being the veiled lady.
Oh.
That, what's her face? Zenobia was the veiled lady. But since we read it, we know that the veiled lady is Priscilla. And I felt really smug because the AI got the thing wrong. And I've been messing around with other bits of like asking it literary stuff and stuff about books. And it really just gives me like a 10th grade English paper summary of the book. So I'm not saying you shouldn't worry about the AI takeover and Terminator, the movie literally happening, but it seems like it's kind of just an information aggregator. And as far as using it for like bookish questions, it's, I guess, good for cliff notes.
But what about this? And this might make you worried. What if people who aren't literary, you know, people like you and I, think it's great and that's the level of knowledge they want to get? Even if it's wrong, the AI says it's true.
Well, that could be, I guess that would be the danger with it.
That's the danger.
Because I have some thoughts on this. We won't go too into it now, although I do hope to hit.
I feel like tonight's episode might get very. College degrees, I think, tonight, Matt.
Yeah. Well, hold on. I want to do a tech thing halfway soon. We'll get into that later. But so I have a thing. I think the danger with AI isn't kind of what it's being projected to be. Like it'll take over and grow sentient and be like Terminator movies. I think the danger is that will, like you were saying, that will be all there is. There's potential for so much more when actual humans are doing the writing and the creative work, but the AI might take over and it'll be limited, but that's all people know. Like for instance,
go ahead. Oh, I was just gonna say, have you seen the AI artwork that they've done?
Mm-hmm.
That's a little concerning.
It's
like, I think it looks pretty, but I'm like, that's just AI.
Some of it looks cool or funny. Like, you know, you can have it mesh up certain things. So I wonder, because they're talking like AI will be good for like lawyers, and they're saying maybe even social workers, because it can drag all this information, and what would take, you know, a lawyer, a bunch of interns a week to go through all this old case law, the AI can do like that. It'll increase automation. And so here's my worry. My car wouldn't start the other day. And I have it free tow, like convenience. I have just like app on my phone and I got it towed. But it used the location on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at my house and it just had my address. So let's say my address is 8900 whatever avenue, right?
Yeah.
And just do the location on my phone, have my neighbor's house across the corner is 8989. And so it was en route to 8989, the wrong house. And so I was like, oh, okay. So I corrected it and it was still 8989. You know, so it was very convenient. They sent a tow truck out to my house, but
towed your neighbor's car.
Well, no, I was able to call and I had to just eventually talk to the tow truck guy and say, hey, it's me over here at 8900. He's like, oh, cool. Okay. Right? So in a future where everything becomes automated and you literally can't talk to a person, those little types of things I think are going to happen. Have you ever lost a bag, like gone on vacation and a bag gets lost at the airport?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you try it, like you go round and around and around and you talk to automated people on the phone. And a lot of the times what you need is just talk to a person and tell them your kind of unique scenario, like, hey, we're moving on, we're going to Chicago, we'll be here, so don't send the bag to where I was, send it to Chicago. And you just need to tell a person that and they can fix it. So I think you think it's bad now with all the automated phone calls and everything, and it's tough to get a person to actually speak to and fix your issue. Just wait till there is no person. It's all AI. It'll be very convenient for the companies running things, but very inconvenient for us. So I'm always skeptical when people say, oh, AI is going to be great for everybody, like on a human scale for the masses. I actually doubt that. I bet it will be more of a headache, like a lot of little bureaucratic headaches and inconveniences for us, but it'll save powers that be, corporate people, money. So that's kind of what I'm looking forward to in the next 5 to 10 years before the robot uprising. I think it might just be just a pain, a royal pain in the neck.
That was very, very, very well put. About 10 seconds into that, Matt, something popped in my head, and that was the only thing I was thinking about. So I do apologize, but I wanted to tell you what I was thinking about.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, what if you got two AI programs to talk to each other? Would they know that the other one was AI?
See, that would be, you could kind of trick.
Yeah. And then I thought of like a whole just AIs talking to each other. That's all I was thinking about while you went on a very passionate, well-reasoned. I was thinking, what if the AIs talk to each other? Wow. I didn't know.
How would you know it's well-reasoned?
Yeah, it's true. I don't know. I didn't hear any of it because I was thinking about the AIs talking to each other.
Well, I wonder if that happens on Twitter. I think
bots talk to each other?
Well, I wonder, right?
How often do bots talk to each other?
Because there are bots. So I wonder if bots get in arguments with each other. I know people get in arguments with bots. So I wonder, it's got to happen, right?
Do you know that if you put infinite number of bots in a room, they'll create the complete works of Shakespeare? I think that's the same, right?
I heard that with monkeys.
No, I think it's bots.
No.
Yeah.
This thing originated an infinite amount of monkeys at a typewriter.
Infinite, or is it just one? It could be one, too.
It's like hundreds, like 100 monkeys given infinite time banging on a typewriter. Given enough time, one of them is eventually going to write the complete works of Shakespeare with just a couple typos in Hamlet.
That's
the saying.
Okay. But I think it works for bots, too.
I guess it would. It might.
I don't know. It all
shorter robots.
I worry if the art stuff is so good, what happens with music and books? Couldn't AI just create stuff like that?
I wonder about books.
I think books is plausible.
I don't know. Could you tell? They have been doing articles, like certain articles, like fluffy, you know, those types of the stupid like clickbait stuff.
Yeah.
Because like they can aggregate information and pull up. So if you know, one of those like recipes, how do I make potato soup? And it'll just, you know, the article.
Yeah.
But I don't think a good literature, I'm skeptical of its ability to create any sort of meaningful or good literature.
Well, how about, here's what I just thought. You know how when we were in college, there were like what was the thing that teachers were worried about? Like you could not copy papers, but there was some, I never used it. I never was quite sure, but there was some sort of like, I don't know exactly, plagiarism thing that they were worried about. It's like, I think it was computer-based, but I'm not entirely sure what it was.
I don't know. I never, there was never the technology to do.
Never the technology, but I wonder in 20 years, teachers are going to have talks like, don't have the AI write the paper.
Well, I hear some of them are worried about it right now.
Oh, okay.
Because like I say, you could in theory do it, the ChatGTP, you could do a Blithedale romance little thing. It would give you the information of what it's about. So you could probably use it to do that.
If I ask it to write a poem, will it write me a poem?
I've seen people mess around with like writing poems. It actually won't do certain things though. That's another thing to bring up. It is programmed to do stuff.
Okay.
Like there's certain political things it won't do. There are certain taboo words it won't say, which is, you know, fine. But the point is, it's programmed to do certain things, and it will tell you if you ask it to praise a certain like taboo political people. It'll say, no, I can't do that. But it will write poetry. I think all it might be capable of right now is sophomore level high school papers as far as literature goes. I don't know if it could fool it. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see.
Got me worried. Man.
I'm worried about different things than I think other people are.
At the end of the day, I just kind of want the AIs to talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And just see what they talk about. Yeah. And on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books. And are we AI? I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Oh, Matt, the AI. That was a movie 20 years ago. Now it's real life. Minority Report. All those movies that I thought weren't going to happen. The pre-cons.
I never saw AI.
That's kind of weird.
I've seen Terminator and Minority Report.
That's good. I've only seen Terminator 2 and I think 3. Mm-hmm. I probably have seen parts of 1. But
1 and 2 are good. The rest kind of meh.
Matt, I lost a bet a while ago.
I remember.
I had to read some essays that you picked out for me. And mm-hmm. Part of tonight's episode is we're going to be discussing some of those essays as the biggest fan of the podcast says goodnight, Matt's son. Just a side note, I expect my dogs to start barking at some point during this episode. So if you hear dogs barking below me, I am in the attic. So we have all the side notes covered here tonight. Matt made me read, not made me read. I chose to comply with these. Some David Foster Wallace essays. That is not Matt. He's talking right now. And I picked up the essay collection, Consider the Lobster.
Okay.
As a little bit of backstory, I have not read David Foster Wallace. And Matt is, would you consider yourself a fan?
Yeah.
Fan. Okay.
Fan.
I think I had some preconceived notions about who he was and judged him maybe a little bit.
His reputation kind of precedes him. People know who he is.
He's a little bit larger than life figure, I would say.
And it's kind of, if I'm noticing, a lot of book people kind of, it's kind of soured from what his reputation might have been 20 years ago.
Good night, Jack.
Good night.
Good night. Hey, this is a podcast where a toddler will say good night to you. His reputation has diminished, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, for some people, I think a lot of people, as you reach a certain height or a certain reputation as being good or a brilliant, quote unquote, brilliant writer, you can only go down. You reach certain heights and then it becomes fashionable to kind of pick you apart. So I think he's there now.
Okay.
But.
So you reread the essays we read were the two we're going to be talking about. I have more to read this year are Consider the Lobster and The Host, right?
Yes. It's called The Host.
Before I get into my thoughts, rereading him, do you have any change in your appreciation of them? Do you think more highly of these stories or same, or were they what you remembered?
Yeah, about the same. It's been fun because it really has been, I think, about 15 years now.
Really?
This
came out in what, 2005 maybe?
This collection was 2005, 2006-ish.
Okay.
Public essays. The collected essays were kind of what got me into them. I'd heard about them. The essays are really more accessible than his fiction. And I really like it. I'm getting the sense we might differ here, but I liked it. I revisiting it. I still like them. I find them engaging. I thought he's obviously curious about what's going on around him, and he's way less judgmental than I think a lot of modern essayists are. So he can kind of get into people's heads more. And one of the things I liked about Host was he kind of just gives you the layout of what's going on. He clearly doesn't agree with the talk radio guy, but he'll step back and just describe what's going on. I really like them. I think they're brilliant essays. Yeah, I enjoyed them just as much.
All right. Let's start with the one that I like considerably more than the other, and that's Considered the Lobster, which is basically him going to the Maine Lobster Festival, and which kind of starts out as a, from my, like how I took it, as like sort of a nuts and bolts look at sort of like a, this cultural thing in this place, right?
Yeah.
Where like the country, a regional thing, like a regional, you know, the Texas State Fair is a well-known one, but you know what I mean?
It's like a state fair for lobster.
Yeah.
And so, the article was commissioned by Gourmet Magazine. So not one of these highfalutin literary magazines either. So it's interesting to keep the audience in mind too.
That's true. I didn't really consider that. And it ends up kind of being this meditation on, do lobsters feel pain? Because he gets to the point where lobsters are prepared, usually kind of boiled alive.
And they scramble and try to get out of the tank. So I thought it was an interesting meditation on that. And you keep in mind, it's written for like Gourmet Magazine, people who kind of don't want to think about this stuff.
It's kind of subversive, I would say.
A little bit.
Kind of. I really enjoyed it. Like if I picked up Gourmet Magazine, I don't know if I would be expecting that kind of story, but it was a pleasant surprise. I will say he's much funnier than I kind of was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a little bit more humor in his writing. I would say actually more in Host than in Considered the Lobster.
He's funny.
So he's not, it wasn't as sort of serious, I don't know, just sort of consider me a serious writer and these are very important things. And if you don't consider the morality of eating lobster, then you're a bad person. I didn't, that was not the sense I got.
He wasn't preachy or judgmental. I don't think he was a vegetarian the rest of his life. He's just kind of bringing stuff up.
Curious mind too, I would say. Like a curious writer and a curious thinker.
That's what made
him credit for.
That's what made the essays so good. Is he's just very curious and he notices things. It's kind of like the roving eye. You know, he can kind of like walk around, see what's going on. In the other collection, the supposedly fun thing I'll never do again, one of the essays you have to read is him going on a cruise, and it's pretty funny. I will go as far to say delightful, just the way he describes the cruise. He goes to the Iowa State Fair in that collection. So all his essays, he usually gets commissioned to go out and write about something, and he'll describe what he sees very lucidly and compellingly and humorously, but he'll also kind of bring up some ancillary point, like the lobster thing.
Did he write an essay about Roger Federer?
That's in his posthumous essay collection. He was a tennis guy.
Yeah.
He was ranked like, you know, junior, whatever, the under 18 junior. He was a middling to big time tennis pro guy. And then he turned to writing.
When I think of David Foster Wallace, one of the first things I think of is footnotes, right? Like he's notorious, mm-hmm. like Infinite Jest has just, it's one of its kind of stylistic pillars, I guess. I don't know. And he has them in Considered Lobster. They're not, some of them are kind of long, but they're not distracting. They're kind of normal, mm-hmm. is how I would put them. As we transition into the Host, it gets a more, I would say, experimental. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, and that maybe I'm thinking about it now because I'm so used to him. Maybe we should have, I shouldn't have started you with host because that was a lot of footnotes. Let me just say, I think the way he used footnotes, and I know for sure in Infinite Jest, the footnotes are there on purpose to kind of mimic the fractured nature of modern life, right? We grew up with TV and it's always cut to commercial. There's so many things that are vying for our attention and it's hard to focus on one thing. So the footnotes were a way of kind of mimicking a modern novel or an essay, mimicking the fractured nature of reality. So it's done intentionally. And I think especially with Host, it was published in The Atlantic, I believe. And the main most of those footnotes, it wasn't structured like that. The footnotes got cut out. And you just put them back in
Okay.
the book form. So.
Because I'll be completely honest, in The Host, it's a longer story. It's a pretty long story with the footnotes included. It kind of made my head hurt at the very end. Just because, for the listener, if you never read the story, it's almost like there's like boxes of like the footnotes are kind of within the page. And oftentimes there's a arrow from the text to say, hey, this is the footnote connected to that. So your eyes are kind of, and sometimes the footnote on the right page is from the left text. So there's an arrow going across, kind of across the spine of the book, so to speak. And so by the end of it, I kind of had like a mild headache from reading the book, the essay. And combined with the subject matter, which it's Host is about, he spends day in the life of a conservative shock jock
Talk radio guy in
talk radio
LA.
guy. And
I think he was there for a week or two. He had a lot of
it
time
did seem
to
it's
sit
yeah day
back
in
and
life,
observe.
I mean, is sort of a prolonged exposure to a very unlikable person. Which is
But
not the fault of, whatever. That's but at the end I'm like, I kind of don't want to be in this essay anymore. Is
oh, really? See, I appreciated it. You read between the lines, you get the feeling he doesn't really like the guy, Wallace.
yeah.
He makes an attempt to actually get in his head and describe what this guy's thinking, what he's feeling, why he's like this. You get the sense he likes the tech guy and the editor.
Yeah.
And he just kind of he does it. He did his research on. There's lots of little technical things which I could see boring people about in the footnotes about the technological equipment and the microphone wattage and all that. But I thought it is interesting when I say it, he withheld judgment, and it was so refreshing because ultimately I don't think he cares for the guy. Wallace's politics are different than John Ziegler's, is the shock jock's name. But I think a lot of interesting stuff was wrought from, I'm just going to observe and try to understand this guy as best I can and lay it all out. I think that works so much better because I think if that sort of thing was commissioned today, it would be, oh, this guy's dangerous. I can't believe people say this stuff. And it would be a worse essay for it.
I did appreciate the sort of the meshing the worlds of, I'm going to use the term art form of talk radio, like in quotes. It's not, I don't think it's, but you know what I mean? Like there is a skill to doing this. Combine that with the technical aspect of radio and how it works and all the sort of the jargon, the lingo, sort of the mechanisms to how it you create a show and all the sort of timing issues. Those two worlds combining together is I thought it was like fascinating. My biggest issue, and the one that held me up from actually like enjoying it was purely the style of the story.
I should have thought of that before.
It
I'm
was
used to
it's
it, but
just so overboard, and it made me just kind of just like I sort of understood the concept of why the style was the kind of the way it was, and just sort of a you could kind of tie it to maybe how talk radio works in some way. But just
well.
as reading it was annoying, and it's like, well, I could understand it or whatever. It's just I don't know. It's just like, can we just add some of this into the bulk of the actual essay and not have, I mean, some of it, there's like half a dozen footnotes on it, and there's barely any of the actual, like, you know, essay, so to speak. And so that was my biggest, and I was like, oh, this is, in my head, this is like, oh, this is the David Foster Wallace that I had in my head before. And I was like, oh, this is not, I'm not enjoying this. Subject matter was interesting. I liked the concept of it, but just the style and the format was just not my cup of tea, so to speak, Matt.
Okay.
Sorry. This is, oh, it's okay. Your brother wants us to disagree more on the podcast, and here I am.
No, it's all right. I should have thought of that. I really, what got it into my head to have you read this one was I remembered the parts about how talk radio is harder than you'd think to do. You set a person alone for a microphone. It's just you're on your own. Talk about something you care about for 10 minutes, then stop talking. You know, like it's a bigger skill than people realize. But I forgot. I'm so used to those footnotes and how it's done that I forget what it'd be like for a newbie. But yeah, and you know, I do talk radio or something in your car. It is kind of fractured like that.
Yeah.
Little thoughts will come to you, and then you'll have to stop at a red light, and you'll see something weird walking by. So I think it's meant to mimic the fractured nature of that.
I see the argument, but I just, it did not work.
Yeah.
I think I'm a little like on the subject matter of, you know, why of kind of talk radio and why the outlandish things they say. I'm kind of tired of the whole subject, I'll be honest with you. That didn't help the essay. I think it was probably more fresh 15 years ago when this came out, because talk radio maybe was in the first decade, you know, kind of Rush Limbaugh in the early 90s kind of kicks it off as a, as a kid, that was like the first thing radio figure that I can remember being like, very, very famous.
He and Howard Stern, yeah.
Yeah, Howard Stern, yeah, those two. And then it's just kind of like, okay. And at the end of the day, the one thing with this, John Ziegler, is that his name?
Yeah.
This is very like, I was just like, this guy's a loser. I was just like,
he's not likable.
He has some, and it also highlights, he did some very despicable things on radio and continued to get radio jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to, did you look up what John Ziegler's doing today?
I think it's a similar thing, right?
So read the essay to sort of get his, he's shocked that he's not married. And you're like, are you really that surprised? Mm-hmm. To report, he is married and has two kids, which I thought was surprising. Can you guess in the essay, he's what really gets him mad is the OJ Simpson trial. It's sort of like
he had some opinions on OJ.
Yes.
Opinions. Yeah.
Do you want to guess a story that he sort of gravitated to and took the contrarian sort of viewpoint on? You're not going to guess it. It is the Jerry Sandusky trial.
Oh, okay.
And he interviewed Jerry Sandusky, and at first thought he was guilty, and then sort of vouches for
his mind.
Yeah. And I was like, really? That's your. I'm like, okay. And it was just like, these guys are. It's just.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. So.
Yeah. Well, and the point is, I was fascinated not because I liked the Ziegler guy.
No, I know. That's not, but I was just.
You know, it's interesting. I don't think Wallace kind of cared for him either, but I just appreciate going into a place. I think half of that was a guy going into the lion's den and just kind of watching, observing. Because it was kind of a phenomenon back then. It's kind of grown. It is more tiresome now. Politics in general for me is more tiresome now. But yeah, in 2004, it would have been maybe not as played, but I liked the way he handled it. He was more curious than judgmental, at least in his writing.
He has like the editorial, like the footnotes that are some of the are like editorial sides, and he kind of I think he has some fun with those because he kind of like how he labels the editorial sides are. It's kind of funny, like strongly.
Semi-editorial, just statement of fact, like that sort of thing. Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I'm not a huge footnote person in general with fiction or nonfiction. It just, I'd rather just read the text itself, but that's my personal, because it oftentimes like gets me out of the rhythm of the writing, and in the host essay case, it was just like overload for my brain.
It's too much.
It's like, oh my gosh. And honestly, I said to myself, if I don't finish this in one sitting, I won't want to pick this back up again. That sounds harsh, but it was just like, I'm in it right now. I just have to finish this. And it's like a 60 page.
Yeah. I had 40 pages left last night, and I knew I had last night for bed and this morning to finish. And I found myself enjoying it so much. It was like easy.
See, that's funny.
That's where we,
that's, I think that's, yeah.
That's might be an acquired, it might be an acquired taste. I don't know. It was pleasant. It was very pleasant for me.
Your history with him helps, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because there's certain things where I like something where I understand it might be like not everyone's cup of tea.
Acquired taste. Literally like tea. Because you know how you do coffee wrong and tea wrong. You do the bad tea and Folgers. And I'm trying to get you into the whole bean and the loose leaf tea and all that. And so...
Okay.
This is acquired. This is taste, you know.
But I when his prose is, I did find his prose. I liked it. Like I said, it was formatting and sort of the style and structure of it that was But I would consider the Lobster I like quite a bit more than Host.
There are others that I think you'd like just as much. We'll do in a month or two, whenever you're ready, we'll do the cruise ship one. I think you'll love that in the other collection. I mean, there's more good ones in the one called Up Simba in this collection. Is him, he followed John McCain's primary campaign against George W. Bush in 2000. And it's kind of as apolitical as something like that can be. It's interesting to see him be on a campaign bus. There's one that I think of a lot, the essay called How Tracy Austin Broke My Heart. I think she's a tennis player, and he was really looking forward to her autobiography. And he read it and is like, yeah, there's nothing there but a bunch of cliches. Mm-hmm. And what always stuck with me is a lot of those athlete biographies, even Michael Jordan, like any of the big guys, you read them and you want like a glimpse into what makes them so great. And it really is just all a bunch of cliches, like work hard, put your faith in God, blah, blah, blah. And the point he made was, I think that really is the secret. There's no intellectual secret to athletic greatness. It really is day in, day out, acting out those cliches. You just get up, work really hard. You spend 6 to 8 hours swimming or practicing or whatever. And that's it. It's really boring, but, and that's why athletic biographies by athletes usually are disappointing. Cause
they're kind of robots in a way.
They're like robots. We put kind of internalized cliches and
you put a lot of like meaning and like poetic, you know, description of the actual action itself, but then the athlete comes back and it's just sort of, they're so singularly focused on one thing that it doesn't match with how you view it. Like, oh my
God. Yeah, I get up, I work hard every day, and that's it.
Yeah.
And you're like, now a guy like George Plimpton could come in and give it some flavor, but he hadn't been an athlete his whole life. You know? So that always stuck with me. There are better essays I should have gone with. But hey, three into the deep end. Host.
I will say this. I've read one essay. I never felt like I never understood the point or the drive behind the two essays. And I have felt that in like some mod. I read, can't remember the collection I read. And it had gotten all these great reviews. And this is I can remember it, I'll say it, but it got all these great reviews, and I was reading these essays. I'll be honest with you, I couldn't make heads or tails about what the point was. They were all sort of like meaningless. I was like, I must be dumb, or these don't have, I'm not seeing the, you know, the through line, the connect. I'm like, this is just sort of, it reminded me of reading like college professors' poetries, where they would have these readings and the poetry was just so filled with just like references to other poems, of course, you haven't read, and you're just like, that meant nothing to me.
Yeah.
So that, I didn't feel that with these essays. These were like, they're not surface level, they're like in depth, but there's a point to them that you see.
They're accessible.
Yes.
And I really do think there is something to showing up and just trying to communicate to the audience what you see and what you find interesting. And that was considered the lobster. It was very, you get a sense for Maine, how the locals feel about this big festival, a sense of the scope and the size, like the millions of pounds of lobsters that are brought in.
I did like the, I think it was a footnote where he's thinking about, you go to these places and you kind of ruin them as tourists. Like the notion of like tourism, he kind of has this aside, which I thought was very like well thought out and interesting, of like, you go to these places and you sort of like going to them ruins them actually. And so it's sort of like a little bit of a catch 22. Like
the fact that you're a tourist and you're there to get a glimpse of how life genuinely is lived there. But a lot of places like Europe and other like tourists,
you spoil it in a way. So
by virtue of being there, it becomes less genuine. Yeah.
I like that. Like little aside, it got me thinking. It's like, oh man, why go anywhere?
Well, that's the other thing, you know? Yeah.
But anyway,
yeah, I don't know. There was point in Host. He talks about that Phil Hendry guy. I don't know if you've heard of him. He does like the funny voices.
Okay.
He was one of the first guys when I got my first job.
Is that the guy who like would provide the continue? I think I know.
Yeah.
With the,
so yeah. He does the, when I got my first job and you know, when I was 15, like driving home from work at like 11 o'clock at night, he was on the radio, and I kind of fell for it. I remember the first thing I heard was this radio guy interviewing this call. His guest was a professional driver, and a lot of the times he was talking about how he does 90 miles per hour through like residential streets, but it's okay because he's got special driving gloves, you know. And then he has people calling in, is like, how dare you, that's so reckless.
Okay, yeah, I know you're talking about that. Actually sounded like a radio thing that I would like to listen to,
that sort of gimmick. And the guy actually is pretty funny, and it took me a little bit to figure out, okay, he's doing both the voices, he's being goofy on purpose, and the callers are, there's a question of if the callers are even genuine, or if he's just kind of, he's messing with people, having people do outlandish things, and then getting people to call in and act baffled. And the show itself is pretty funny, at least to 15-year-old me. But Wallace called it cruel. And it's like, I guess I can see kind of where he's coming from. But in cases like the tourist thing and with the Phil Hendry being cruel thing, I was kind of reminded he was a little sensitive, just saw the world maybe more sensitive. And, you know, I don't know, it's just kind of an aside, but I don't know if the Phil Hendry is cruel so much as, because they're willingly calling in. He's not harassing random people on the street. You know?
Well, yeah, it seemed like his audience was people who were in on the joke, who knew the format, and then people who would just like randomly be on some sort of AM radio station and listening and be like, wait, what?
And they call and are offended. I don't.
So, and then eventually, and it was a national show, right? So odds are that there was going to be new people listening to each, you know.
It's a syndicated show,
So, anyway. Maybe, you know, this is early days of the internet. He wasn't, I mean, I would think it would be a little bit harder to do now, but you never know.
I think he's still around, but, you know, I don't know.
I know, I was looking up some of the radio people, and So, any other thoughts on David Foster Wallace? I'm still going to read the other aspects. I haven't Don't let my dislike of host.
No, it's all right. We'll do the cruise ship one next at some point. I think that'll be a little better for you.
And these ones were in Consider the Lobster. So if you're interested, if you think kind of these subjects are interesting, they're in Consider the Lobster and Other Essays by David Foster Wallace. So,
hey, real quick, just lobster random stuff.
Yeah.
Do they have live lobsters at the grocery store anymore?
I was thinking that too. I know the grocery store I go to does not.
No, I
don't think they really. I think you have to go to, I'm trying to think, like a Whole Foods possibly. I think they do. But I don't think every grocery store, like a big, you know, Kroger or something like that. I don't think they do.
I remember they used to. I remember thinking they were really cool at the store when I was a kid. You go shopping with your mom, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember that was one of my favorite parts of the store, is seeing the lobster tank. And I was thinking, I don't think any place I go to in town has lobsters anymore, live lobsters.
You know what was really interesting? I didn't realize that lobster was considered like a peasant food.
Yeah.
That was fascinating.
It used to be poor people food. In fact, he says in a footnote, back in the day in the 1800s, 1900s, when they were actually meaner to prisoners, it was okay to, they had a rule where you couldn't feed lobsters to prisoners more than once a week, because that would have been cruel and unusual.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line it shifted, and now it's considered kind of hoity-toity.
I've never bought a lobster, I'll be honest. You ever bought lobster? Neither.
No. I don't know that I've ever had lobster. Like, it's, if I go to a Red Lobster surf and turf place, I usually get the steak.
Okay.
But I didn't grow up having a lot of seafood. So, that was an interesting, that was an interesting.
I like that. Style.
I also like, did you catch the point he made where for like lobster, fish, chicken, shrimp, all that stuff, the name of the meat, like our name of the meat and the egg was the same. But when you get to mammals, the cow is the animal, and we have different words, like beef for the meat. We kind of have to like separate it in our mind, like pig and pork. Yeah, it was interesting.
That was interesting. I was like,
it was full of little stuff like that. And that's would you consider that more legitimate use of the footnote? Yes. That's not the main body of the text, but hey, here's this interesting.
I know, those two examples you just talked about, I thought those were like highlights for me. I really enjoyed those. And I was like, oh, that's kind of highlights his curiosity as a like writer and thinker, I thought.
Yeah.
So not all negative here. I feel like I'm being very negative, but I'm there's some stuff that I really liked as far as actual, like the content of it. So
he's an entertaining writer.
Yeah. I now read David Foster Wallace, and I will continue to read essays. I'll be honest. I don't know if I can make, if the footnotes are like they are in Host, I don't know if I could finish Infinite Jest.
In Infinite Jest, they're at the back. So you could, in theory, read
it. Just read the.
And just not. They don't get in the way of the text.
You had a whole system of.
Just two bookmarks.
Okay. Two bookmarks.
Right. And I did read them. It is easier than Host. But in theory, you could go through and not read the footnotes. Although I think you should. I won't bug you about Infinite Jest unless, if our patrons demand it.
Okay.
Then I can do it. But I'm not going to like push it on you before you're ready. You know.
It's a big book.
Is it? It would be like Life and Fate is for us. It would take a while.
Yeah.
But like I say, don't worry. Don't sweat that one. It's all right.
We do have the business of selecting an April book. So we are going to do our nominations tonight. It's not as late in the month as we sometimes get with our monthly nominations. So we're kind of on you know, schedule here. Did you have any themes, Matt, before we get into our nomination? Any sort of?
Oh, I got a theme. I'll let you know. What about you?
I kind of have a it's sort of a theme. Two of the three books are themes.
Okay. All right. Well, let me tell you mine.
Okay.
You know what we did two Aprils ago?
Remind me.
The Anthony Bourdain.
Oh, yes.
You know what we did last April?
No.
Xenophone.
I'm not sure how those are connected.
Anabase, both nonfiction.
Okay. So,
I figure try to make it a nonfiction April.
Oh.
About time. So mine are all nonfiction.
I like it. Two of mine are memoirs. One.
Hey.
Yeah. But I wouldn't say they're like the first things you think of nonfiction. They're fiction writers writing nonfiction.
Okay.
Famous.
I got the concept.
Okay. I'm just saying. They're more known for their fiction. So
I understand.
And then I tried to find a third book and I was like, let me just, and then I, you know, thought of something else and came up with a third book. So
hey, let's see how it goes. I do have something I really want to do, but we'll see.
I have one that's more that I might push for than the other ones. So that's usually the case. Do you want to go first, Matt? A little nonfiction.
Yeah, I have four.
Okay. So,
all right. Hey, this one, I might just be bringing it up because I bought it and I've wanted it for a while and I found a good deal. So
yeah.
Just talk about it. It might be as maybe a little too long, 650 pages.
That's pretty big.
To actually do. But it's called The Cousins Wars by Kevin Phillips.
Okay.
It is kind of a look at the English Civil War with like Cromwell, the Roundheads versus the Cavaliers and all that. The American Revolution and the Civil War and kind of how those are all similar. He kind of draws a line through all three of those.
That does sound good.
British Anglo-American culture, how the British Anglo-American culture, how that we know today kind of came about because of those wars, how they were fought, what happened, who wound up winning and wresting control of the government societies due to those three kind of successive wars. And I gather Phillips has kind of a theory that British culture influences American culture more than we kind of recognize. So
This actually sounds very interesting.
I think it'd be fertile grounds for discussion and whatnot. Come up as a seasonal, maybe.
Possibly, yeah.
I mean, guess where you could just do it for an April. But I found it. I wanted it for a while. I found it for $6.
There you go. It's a steal.
Cool. Yeah.
I like that. Let me do my one that's actually not tied to my theme first. Kind of, I had one theme like when I started that I was like, maybe I'll do this. And I kind of like added on to the end as I went to my second theme. And that is kind of rereading maybe an author we really liked. And the one that came to mind was Larry McMurtry. We both like Lonesome Dove. And I'm not going to nominate one of the next book sort of in the series, but I was thinking maybe a standalone book. And I settled on The Last Picture Show by Larry McMurtry, kind of about teenagers in a kind of lonesome small Texas town. I didn't realize that the movie that was adapted from this novel is very famous and is kind of this heralded 1970s classic movie. So that's my first nomination. Larry McMurtry's The Last Picture Show.
Yeah, he's got a couple modern novels that are very, supposedly very good, very famous. Because any Terms of Endearment too?
Yes.
Yeah.
So
maybe Dove made people think, oh, he's the Western guy.
This would have been from the 60s.
Yeah.
I think it takes place in the like 61, I want to say.
I think he did a lot of Texas stuff.
Yeah. This book is
not just Westerns, but just modern Texas, contemporary for him when he wrote it.
And I'm curious if since we're Lonesome Dove fans, like, I don't think this book, I think maybe he gets a lot of people get introduced to him through Lonesome Dove. And I'm wondering, is this sort of another, if you don't want to, I do want to continue on with the kind of Lonesome Dove. It's a trilogy, right?
Yeah.
But sort of his other writings, like his other standalone books, is this a good entry point? I was trying to figure that out, and this is the one that kind of stood out to me. So if you're listening to this, you can send us a note on or an email and let us know. Is this kind of a good entry point, or are there better books to kind of expand the Mercury, you know, canon, so to speak? So
yeah, what other than Lonesome Dove?
Because there's other kind of, I want to say Western series. I'm kind of thinking of other outside of like Western.
Yeah. But,
Matt, your next nomination.
All right. Hey, Peter, do you think human beings are the be-all, end-all?
No. We just talked about AI. Can't be.
Do we, as a species, sit above the animals? Are we better than animals? Are we animals ourselves?
I sometimes think about that question actually more than I think about us and animals.
We are animals. Well, there is a cultural distinction in our heads. It's like, we are animals, but we're actually much better. But you might, if you think about stuff like that, you might like this next book. It's called Straw Dogs. John Gray, the British guy, but he spells Gray with an A. Go figure.
John Gray. Okay. Thoughts
on humans and other animals. It's an exciting, radical work of philosophy that sets out to challenge our most cherished assumptions about what it means to be human. You said another book by John Gray. I started this one. I really like it. It gets called cynical, but I think it's just so different from the common narrative that we have about ourselves and our culture that people kind of get crushed by it and call it cynical. I think it's just kind of more rational, reasonable. It explodes the myth of progress, basically.
Nothing will get you thinking as much as this brilliant book, The Sunday Telegraph. At once daunting and enthralling, Gray's remarkable new book shows us what it would be like to live without the distraction of consolations. Adam Phillips. All right, Matt. We've never done philosophy on the podcast.
Yeah, and it's not impenetrable. It's philosophy, but it's, you ever read some of that academic philosophy? It's so hard and it's almost not worth it. This is accessible.
I'm open to this.
Okay.
I'm open to the challenge. This one, it's kind of like Blithedale Romance. I'm like, oh, I'm a little interested. Wasn't on my radar, but maybe.
Nice.
I don't know if that analogy is probably pretty bad, but.
No, I know exactly what you mean, which is all you want out of an analogy.
Exactly. All right, Matt, my second nomination. I am more curious by this author's nonfiction than their fiction, which they're mostly known for.
Are they alive?
No, they're not alive. And that would be George Orwell. And I feel like I've nominated some of his nonfiction before, and this time I'm going to nominate Down and Out in Paris and London. Just basically his vagabond days in Paris and London.
Yeah.
And kind of talking about, I want to say this would be in the 20s or 30s.
I think so, yeah.
This is my latest George Orwell nonfiction nomination.
That's really good. I've wanted to read that for a while. Have you read? I read Homage to Catalonia.
Is that the one I nominated before? I nominated one of his kind of other famous works.
I read it right before we started the podcast. Okay. It was good. I think you'd like that one. It was the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah, because I'll be honest, like 1984, I think I read that in high school. And I was like, okay, you know, it's interesting. But I think he gets just so tied to that, that his other works sound much more interesting to me. And like I said, the nonfiction and sort of some of the other fiction too. It's kind of not a shame that he's like,
yeah,
George Orwell's 1984. Like that's like kind of.
Well, that's his famous
stuff. So
it actually holds up pretty well, but you're right. It is kind of just so famous.
Yeah, it's
people use it as an analogy sometimes when it shouldn't be. But I would argue 1984 actually is pretty good and holds up for what it is. But you're right. His essays are incredible.
Okay.
He's very articulate and he's a very good essayist. And I liked Homage to Catalonia. This is a good, it's a very tempting nomination, Peter.
All right. That's not even the one I want to push for. So, okay. All right. Your next nomination, man.
All right. I think I've talked about this before. This is big in the internet zeitgeist 5 years ago. So we'd be coming at it 5 years too late, but
I think that's fitting for our podcast, but
yeah.
I almost nominated Sally Rooney.
Hey, keep in mind later.
Later,
maybe May or June. Hey, do you think art determines culture or culture determines art?
I think culture determines art. I don't know. You could convince me.
That's kind of where I fall too. It's kind of where I fall too.
I thought you were looking at me and judging me. And I was like, is that the title of the book?
It took a while to figure out which way. No, this book is called The Culture of Narcissism by Christopher Lash.
Culture of Narcissism.
It's good. It's really good. For all his inner suffering, the narcissist has many traits that make for success in bureaucratic institutions, which put a premium on the manipulation of interpersonal relations. So it's not narcissism necessarily.
Sounds like philosophy too, right there.
Yeah, social science philosophy. It's not like analyzing narcissists in a clinical sense, although there's some of that. It's more like the title, The Culture of Narcissism. Why are there some?
I'm not as interested in that one.
All right. Well, I'm gonna throw it out there. Subtitle is American Life in an Age of Diminishing Expectations.
It sounds too serious, man. I'll be completely.
It might be okay. Well, I might have to finish. I read half of it and then got distracted, but I got a lot of stuff underlined, like that thing I just randomly read. That was just what I underlined.
I like it.
It's good. I might have to read it on my own. And like I said, it was a big deal 5 years ago. But, you know, we're late to the party.
Don't worry. Yeah.
There's a couple of things I remembered from the half that I read. You know, narcissism, most people associate it with, you know, constant self-love.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily constant self-love. It's constant self-involvement. A lot of narcissists hate themselves, but they can't really break out of the self-involvement.
Okay.
Interesting little factoids like that. Good for cocktail parties. I won't push too hard for it, though.
When's the last time you went to a cocktail party?
I've never been to a cocktail party.
I don't think I have either. Okay.
Mainly grill, hang out, and watch basketball with you and Sam.
All right. I like it. My last nomination, and the one I kind of want to read the most out of my list, and that would be A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a look at a who's who of Paris. He actually thought he lost these notebooks, and he kind of turned them into and it was published after his death, I believe. But these notebooks were, from what I was reading, in a Louis Vuitton kind of like suitcase chest type thing that he thought he didn't know were there. And then someone was like, hey, you got all these notebooks. And he's like, oh, and then he kind of compiled kind of a rough outlines of a book and kind of there's some question over what was actually published. Is that what he would have wanted type of thing? But
posthumously, like after he died, they found it?
No.
Or just later.
It wasn't done. He wasn't done compiling it and kind of.
Okay.
So the order and sort of the structure of it was sort of left up to his estate. I could be completely wrong about that. But I don't think I'm that far off. So there's some discussion over, is it actually what he wanted?
Yeah. That's good.
So there's that intrigue, and then you got all the famous people he was hanging out with.
Oh, just the fun. Yeah.
And
pair well with the Dawn Powell. I don't think she wasn't from the Paris in the 20s set, but Hemingway was in her circle later.
I can show I the
Yeah.
Wikipedia has all the people here.
I don't think she didn't go. She was in New York in the 40s and 50s.
Yes.
But yeah, Fitzgerald, Ezra Pound, right? Like
Here
all
we
those.
got James Joyce. Yeah, Fitzgerald. Also the Fitzgeralds, plural. Ford Max,
Zelda,
Ford
yeah.
Maddox Ford, James Joyce, Ezra Pound, Gertrude Stein. Yeah, a ton of people.
Man, that's good.
It was published 3 years after his death, by his fourth wife and widow, Mary Hemingway. There's been some like newer editions, but I've always been curious. I've read most of his fiction, and this would be, I don't think I've read any of his sort of nonfiction. So, is that intriguing to you at all?
Yeah, that's maybe that and Orwell are the, that's very good. I'm very tempted. Yeah, I'm woefully lacking in the Hemingway stuff, and I actually think this would be a good
This might
place.
be a good starting point.
Yeah.
I
No.
don't know. Like, I used to really like Hemingway, but I haven't really revisited him in a while. So,
That could be fruitful. I think it'd be a lot of fun discussion to be had from that. Talk about the setting,
yeah.
Paris.
Kind of, it sounds very like romanticized and.
Well, it's nostalgia for a time you've never visited. You like that movie, the Woody Allen movie, The Midnight in Paris?
Oh, yeah, that he is in that.
Actually, well, that's kind of what
I did see that, yeah.
it's that scene. I actually kind of like that movie.
So, Hemingway. He's kind of, is he falling out of favor? Is he?
Yeah, like I was talking about with Wallace earlier, you get to be so big that the only thing people can do is kind of.
And I'm not saying, like, I think there's some people maybe get like, wasn't a good guy. I'm not gonna argue that.
Oh, I'm
But
so
like the
tired of bias.
books can be the
Yeah.
books and what
The art's the art.
and
I'm
then
so
his
tired of this
writings
return.
to masculine could be
Yeah.
true. All these things could be true. And I could be just read them when I was 18 years old.
Yeah. The modern obsession with just tearing down people for their personal lives, especially when they didn't do anything like criminal. Just, oh, this guy's a bad person. Well, he's a human being who lived into his 60s. He wasn't per like just I'm so tired of that as like a mode of criticism. Whatever. It's beside the point. Gore Vidal was actually pretty funny about Hemingway. He didn't really care for Hemingway. But that may have skewed my perception of him, and I'm kind of realizing like those are funny lines Vidal had, but I should actually kind of maybe read Hemingway for myself.
See, I think it would also, yeah, it'd be that's a, it brings up a good point. There's some, I think a lot of times in culture today, like if someone you really like says an opinion, there's almost like this knee-jerk reaction to agree with it completely. And then the idea of like disagreeing with somebody on certain things, but agreeing with them on other things is sort of like a foreign concept. Maybe in like in criticism and art and stuff, like, oh, you like that? Oh, I can't like them either. And it's just like, eh, come on. It's just,
Or it's just you recognize a funny line. Yeah, like you don't have to pick sides. You can like two authors who don't like each other. You, yeah, I'm with you there.
Your last nomination, man.
All right. So let's see. This is the one I really wanted to do.
Okay.
It's why I chose the intro I did. I think I brought it up. I got it for Christmas. I brought it up then. You were halfway intrigued. It's about technology,
Okay.
humanities. Humanity in the future, the way forward is through, microchips in your brain. Science has figured out that there's no such thing as a soul.
That's
It is
lifting.
Homo Deus by
Oh, yeah.
Yuval Noah Harari, A Brief History of Tomorrow. I'm intrigued. I think I'll disagree with a lot of it, but it's one of those where I'm fascinated by the content and where he's going. And I want to kind of formulate why I disagree with it. Or, maybe he'll convince me and I'll get a brain chip.
This is the second book in the series, or because he
Not
has
a
what?
series. Sapiens was a huge hit for him, and this is kind of his follow-up. But I
Okay.
believe he has other books too. So it's not a I guess Sapiens would be a history of humans.
Gotcha.
And this would be kind of the future. I was kind of interested despite myself, and I asked for it for Christmas and I got it.
It's just like
but it's kind of, it's the tech stuff I wanted to kind of.
Controversial, like,
yeah.
I'm aware of him. I know the books are very popular, but I oftentimes hear like there's some, not drama, but there's some people are like, oh, this is completely wrong, or this is.
Yeah, his ideas. I don't think he's in trouble for his personal actions or anything.
I'm just curious.
No. I think he draws a lot of heat because of his ideas.
Okay.
You know, and I'm pretty sure I disagree with him too, but you know, doesn't mean I can't read the book.
It's true. Okay. I would say that's the one I'm most intrigued by of yours.
That's kind of what I would push for, because I've been thinking about stuff like that recently. It'd be nice to have a little outlet.
Think about
it. And it's not too, you could talk me into Straw Dogs if you really wanted to. That would be another fun one. But I think the most fertile grounds for discussion of mine would be the Harari
Noah. Yuval Noah Harari.
Yuval Noah Harari. Yeah.
Okay. Terrible pronouncing names. All right.
But I really like Movable Feast.
Yeah, me too, Matt. Me too.
It's very tempting.
So where do you want to settle on? Do nonfiction?
We should do a nonfiction.
Okay.
McMurtry's good. Like, that's another tempting one. But I think we should do nonfiction April. I'm all about traditions. I don't know if you noticed. I'm very OCD.
Very traditional.
November is spy novels. April's nonfiction. Okay.
What is August? August is
Splashman. Yep.
All right. Do you want to do Homo? How am I? Deuce?
Deus. It's not Deus as in two. It's a Deus as in God, I think.
Okay.
Like, man, humankind will become as gods. Technology will let us conquer. Oh, death. That's another thing. Oh, we're this close to conquering death.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
They'll be able to crack the code.
This might break my brain. I might. Okay.
It's not difficult. You know what I mean? It's not impenetrable.
Yeah, I know.
It's interesting. It might be a two-parter, too. Peter, I'm about to bring something up.
Yeah.
Don't balk at it. So let's do Homo Deus.
Okay.
Right.
Are you going to do the thing where we add two books a month?
Do you want to do a Movable Feast too? We don't really have time, but you want us to do it anyway?
Yeah, let's do it.
It's not too long, right?
No, it's not.
I want to do a Movable Feast too.
Okay.
I want to talk about stuff in the Harari, and I want to talk about Paris literary scene in the 20th.
There you go. All right. We're going to do two. That wasn't even in my. I wasn't even thinking we did the two.
Well, we probably shouldn't.
Nah, it's all right.
Let's just do it.
Okay.
All right.
I like it. So we've added two books to our TBR this month, as always. It's a very fertile TBR. If that's a saying, it is now. Let me go through what we are reading, so to get an idea of our tall stack of books that we're going through. No particular order. We have A Time to Be Born, The Master and Margarita, The Manticore, J. Bear Crow. We've kind of talked, I don't think we've mentioned this on air, but we are going to read Sutri.
Yep.
So that's on our list. That's like a little surprise for you. I don't think we've mentioned that actually on air.
We got a fun surprise guest that goes along with Sutri.
Yes.
Which is fun.
We have Life and Fate and The Once and Future King. All told, that's probably 4,000 pages on our TBR, maybe.
But we don't get out much, so we will finish. We will finish them halfway soon. Hey, oh, go ahead.
I was also going to mention that is just for our normal podcast. We do have other works that we will be adding over on our Patreon. We have our Thriller Corner book club. We just read Slow Horses over there and did an episode over there. We're going to do baseball books over there. So If you thought our TBR was too long, it's actually longer if you include our Patreon. So, Matt, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was informed this last weekend it is Jaber Crow, not
Jaber. Not Jaber. Jaber.
I gather the guy, it's takes place in Kentucky. And so his guy's nickname was Jay Bird, and it's shortened due to the dialect to Jaber.
Jaber.
Jaber. Jaber. Jaber. Jaber. So
that's a lot of books, man. We have
a lot of books. But I mean, that's kind of, I guess that's what we're doing here.
I have eight right? books checked out from the library right now.
Yeah, you're reading stuff on the side.
Yeah, I am. And that content is over on our Patreon as well, as I do a monthly recap of the books I check out from the library and sometimes read and sometimes most likely don't read. So that's another fun thing. People will like
it. It's gotten some good feedback. I enjoy it too. It's a very entertaining breakdown of Peter's library books.
It's influenced by Nick Hornby. He used to do an article back in the day, and he made an essay, kind of an essay compilation of books he bought that month and then the books he read that month.
Yeah.
And his is more like, obviously more talented. Mine's a little bit more fun, but where the genesis of the concept comes from. So I break it up into fun categories. It's good times.
It's been well received. It's one of the many perks you get for being a patron.
Exactly. Matt, any final thoughts? Any requests?
Keep your eyes peeled. I think our next episode or close to it will be a patron one, and we'll select a new thriller. We have some genres, and I think it'll probably be either a legal thriller, a crime thriller, or like a whodunit-ish. So our next episode, get your say in now. If you have a preference, let us know. Otherwise, we'll probably just bring a bunch of nominations, and we'll pick a baseball fiction book and our new thriller corner book on Patreon. Peter, I'm sorry about host. I'm realizing now I should have saved that for last, and maybe it'd be warmed up. I kind of threw into the deep
you
end.
You have so much goodwill with me for introducing me to Don Powell, who's coming up on our TBR, a book I finished that I could read host 100 times and it would still.
I don't know. Host wasn't that bad. It's just disorienting.
I'm saying no. Don Powell is that good.
Okay.
Well, let's end on that. Don Powell, who you told me to read and said was great. Absolutely. Love Don Powell.
And that will probably be our next normal regular feed episode.
Yes. So. Thanks as always for listening, and we will talk to you soon.
See ya.